WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Fuad Ajami describes Beirut as a city where the veneer of civilization has cracked. Ajami grew up in Beirut in a Shia Muslim family. When he was a teenager, he left Lebanon to study in the United States. He made America his home, but his work has been focused on the Middle East. Ajami directs Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and he's written extensively on the Arab world. Fuad Ajami wrote the text for the new book, Beirut, City of Regrets, which features photographs by Eli Reed. Ajami's essay tells the story of how political catastrophe came to Beirut, how the city became a land of cruelty and hatred, a free-fire zone, a place of kidnappings and car bombings. I asked him if he thought of this essay as a eulogy for the city he grew up in.
I think you have the right word for it. It is in part a eulogy of the city. Here is a city that meant a great deal to not only to the Lebanese, obviously this is their great capital city, but it also meant a great deal to the Arab world. This was a place where the Arab world met Europe, if you will. This was a place where East and West met. I mean, this is a kind of a slogan that people have about Beirut. It's a cliche, but it's very real. And it is one's own. This is the city where I myself grew up in. I was born in the southern part of the country, but like many people from the southern part of the country and the Bekaa Valley in the east, we all converge on the city of Beirut. This was the place where I was schooled. This was the place where I spent my teenage years. And there was something there. If there is such a thing as Arab and Muslim liberalism, and such a thing as the Levant, if you will, in the Arab world, this kind of meeting of East and West, this meeting of Christianity and Islam, to the extent that that world existed, it really existed in Beirut. And it is that world is gone. That world is gone. A poet of Beirut, and the text in the book, The City of Regret, closes with this poet. A poet said, look, nothing remains of old Beirut except the scent of it that blows from old notebooks. So whether Beirut committed suicide or whether Beirut was the victim of homicide, that is, whether others pushed Beirut over the brinks, Israelis, Palestinians, Syrians, Iranians, whatever, whether it's a case of homicide or of suicide, a city and a way of life have really belonged to the past. And it was time, I felt, to write of Beirut and to write of Lebanon, not a political story, but the kind of eulogy that you ask about.
Well, since Beirut, what's happening in Beirut now is so confusing to most Americans, I thought it might be good to try to see the city through your eyes as someone who's both lived there and studied it as well. Now, you moved to Beirut from the countryside of Lebanon when you were around 3 or 4 years old. Right. Why did your family want to move to Beirut?
Well, you see, I think in many ways the politics of Lebanon and the life of Lebanon became the life of an extended city-state. I mean, Beirut, this was the magnet. This was the countryside of Lebanon was being emptied of any economic life. Lebanon was really a poor country. The land was a very poor land. And you saw in Lebanon what you saw in many third world societies, that the city became the great magnet. The city became a place where people could sustain a dream. And in the case of my family, they were tobacco growers. They were really impoverished gentry. A man who came to Lebanon once said about that many of the Lebanese came from royal ancestry and personal destitution, that they were all very proud of their ancestry, but it was also a very poor land. So my family came to Beirut in the mid to late 40s. Other people were making the journey. People from the Bekaa Valley, close to Syria in the east, were making the journey. People from the northern part of the country were making a journey. And at some point in time, I think maybe even more than half the people of Lebanon lived in the capital city. Again, not so much a uniquely Lebanese phenomenon, but a widely third world phenomenon. There was no schooling to speak of in the southern part of the country. And the land was being annulled, economically annulled. It couldn't feed and sustain the people in the hinterland. So we came to Beirut. And, it was the old dream that you would find life and you would find sustenance in the city. In the case of my own family, once they made it to Beirut, they also made another typically Lebanese decision. They went far away out of Lebanon. Some of the men, and even in time, some of the women, my aunts, my father, they left to West Africa and to Saudi Arabia and to other places to make money, and the children remained behind. And so there was always this sense that you make your stand in Beirut, and you know this was where Lebanon converged.
Now, you grew up in a Shia neighborhood.
Yes,
your family were Shiite. Yes. Shiite Muslims.
Yes, I grew up in a neighborhood which is gone now. Which I, in my memory of Beirut and my fantasy and one's own childhood becomes such a precious inheritance. This was an Armenian Shia neighborhood. The Armenians who had been driven out by the Turks from their country had come to Lebanon and had claimed a piece of swampland on the outskirts of the city, in the northeastern part of Beirut, a poor part of the city, and made their home there. So when the Shia of Lebanon came from the Bekaa Valley and came from the southern part of the country, when they arrived in Beirut, they were unable to move to West Beirut, to the Muslim part of Beirut, to the bourgeois, if you will, middle-class part of Beirut. So they moved in with the Armenians. And in this part of Beirut, there were Armenian refugees, Palestinian refugees, Shia who came from the hinterland of the country, Syrians who came to Beirut. There was something to it. I mean, there was something vibrant and wild about this place. It was poor, but there was a tremendous sense of cultural diversity to it. I knew the Armenians very well. I mean, this was the first foreign world, if you will, that I was introduced to.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Fuad Ajami, and he's the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University and the author of many books and articles on his native Lebanon. His latest book is Beirut, City of Regrets. He wrote the text, and there are also photographs by Eli Reed. Now, you write that when you came to Beirut, when you were growing up there, that you really tried to assimilate. And I was wondering what it was you were trying to assimilate to, and what ethnic or religious things you wanted to kind of smooth out to be less noticeable.
Yes, there were many fragments of many worlds in Beirut. I mean, Beirut, there were all sorts of sounds and there were all sorts of cultures there. The elite culture among the Christians was basically what you could call Franco-Arab. The Christians in the eastern part of the city, the Christian elite spoke French. They were dipped in French. T.E. Lawrence, the famous T.E. Lawrence, once said of Beirut that it was bastard French, that there was something of this enormous French culture. Now, on the western part of the city, among the Muslims and among the upper class and middle class Palestinians and the ascendant Muslim classes, the rising Muslim classes, the culture was clearly, the politics was Arab nationalist. The hero of the time was the Egyptian Jamal Abdel Nasser. But there was also a tremendous American presence. This was the presence of the American University in Beirut. So if you grew up in Lebanon, you had a cultural choice to make. Among the Muslims and the Palestinians, the cultural choice was Arab nationalism and then this Anglo-Saxon culture, if you will. This was, you could learn, everyone had to learn Arabic. The issue was, would your second language be English or French? So there was a kind of an American presence. And I suppose that for people who came from the countryside, Shia Muslims, poorer people, there was a dominant elite Lebanese culture that they were trying to plug into. So there were fragments of many worlds, but the culture that counted among the Christians was this French culture. Among the Muslims and the Palestinians was this Anglo-Saxon and then, of course, Arab elite culture.
Well, it sounds like, in a way, what you wanted to cover up almost was being from the country.
Yes, we were exactly, and I don't think it's very unique. I mean, this is a worldwide story. There was the shame of coming from the countryside. In my case, for example, I eventually made it to an American school, an elite American school in Beirut. But to show you this cultural dualism that existed in Lebanon, my mother was a woman of the countryside. She was of gentry peasant background, and she wore a headscarf. She wore a head cover, which deeply embarrassed me in the very, very modern world of Beirut. And there was even something which one now could admit with a touch of guilt. I may have even made a pact with my mother, if I remember, that if she saw me in the modern company that I was keeping, that she stayed away from me. There was something false about the culture of Beirut. There was something of this there was a prissy quality to it, if you will. There was a precious quality to it and a pretentious quality. This was part of Lebanon, and it was part of the culture of Beirut, no doubt.
When you were growing up, did you sense anything like the divisions that exist now. Now Beirut is a divided city. When you were growing up, what were the divisions like between Muslims and Christians?
Nothing, you're right, nothing like what exists now. I mean, this is really Beirut now. It's a tale of two cities, if you will. There is East Beirut, it's one world. There is West Beirut, it's one world. There is Shia Beirut, there is Muslim-Sunni Beirut. There are many Beiruts. Well, in my time, growing up in the 50s and the 60s there, it wasn't war hadn't broken out. Men hadn't taken up arms to fight one another. But let's not kid ourselves. And I think the Lebanese have come to lie a lot in exile, in retrospect about their city and their country. It was always a place where lines were drawn. It was always a place where lines were drawn. Men and women and young men and women always knew and always belonged to one community. The names gave it away. If you ran into a Michelle or a George or a Hannah, this was a Christian. If you ran into a Muhammad or Ali or a Hussein, this was a Muslim. Names gave it away. What's interesting, there were some, and actually this happens to be in my case, there were some names which were secular. Like if your name was Fuad, for example, it was hard to tell whether this was a Christian or a Muslim name. So identities were always flashed, and everyone was their own identity. And in the end, there was a part of Beirut and a part of the world of Beirut on which Muslims and Christians met. But when the day was done, when that interaction was over, after you did business with the Christians and the Muslims, then everyone returned to the cocoon of one's own kinsmen. There was a place, a common ground on which Christians and Muslims met. But I always felt that that common ground was false and obviously fragile, as we came to understand later. The Lebanese really lied to themselves. There were things they used to say that, the Muslim crescent, this is the symbol of Islam, the crescent, that the crescent and the cross embraced in Lebanon. There were all sorts of myths that we had, all sorts of things we said about the country. But I think in the end, the religious sect was the dominant way that Lebanese identified themselves. It was a place of minorities, a place of sects. Suffice it to say, the best way of describing it, this was a country of 4,000 square miles and 17 different religious and ethnic communities. Not only were the lines Muslim and Christians, but even among the Muslims, the Muslim faith divided. There were Sunni Muslims and there were Shia Muslims and there were Druze. And among the Christians, there were Catholic Maronites, Greek Orthodox, Protestant, Greek Orthodox Armenians, etc., etc. It was a world of such obvious diversity and clearly deep antagonisms, which people never really publicly expressed.
You moved to the United States when you were a teenager.
Yes.
To study in America. And I'm wondering if when you came here, although there were so many divisions in Beirut, if when you came here, you were just seen as someone from the Middle East, a Muslim.
You know,
whether Americans just totally erased or refused to acknowledge all the differences that you've just enumerated.
Yes, and I think, for the Lebanese in particular, I mean, in terms of one's own experience, the Lebanese always wanted to signal to Westerners, and maybe we all are guilty of it, all people who came from a Lebanese background, that yes, we are Arabs, but we're really Lebanese, you see. We're a piece of the West washed on the shores of the Mediterranean. There was this duality to Lebanon's existence. Clearly, it was more westernized than the other Arab countries, and it is something that the Lebanese always wanted to flag in their new habitat.
Well, I want to talk with you more about what's happening in Lebanon now, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Fuad Ajami. He's the Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University and has written extensively about Lebanon. His latest book is called Beirut, City of Regrets. He wrote the text. The photographs are by Eli Reed. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Fuad Ajami is my guest, the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He grew up in Beirut. Let me ask you were just talking about, why you decided to stay in the United States. And I'm wondering if you felt that had you gone back to Beirut, you would have had to be a partisan in the kind of growing conflicts between the different groups, if it's easier to see the big picture when you're outside of the city.
Well, it was, one would like to make one's choice so grand. I think it was just there was a world here that was open. and there was a world in Lebanon that was closed. There was a world here that was large, and there was a world in Lebanon that was very small. Lebanon was, you know, Lebanon was always the biggest export of Lebanon. One Lebanese once reminded his compatriots. He said, "Don't be so arrogant about this country. The biggest export of this country are Lebanese people. Wherever you go, in South America, in West Africa, in North America, this has always been a country that drove men away. It banished them to other places. It banished them to other places, and there, in faraway places, the people there remembered how beautiful the land was. They talked of the echo of church bells in the valleys and so on. But there was one reality. It was always a poor land, and it could not sustain people's dreams. And the dreams in the country, and this may even have a large political meaning, the dreams were bigger than the place would sustain. People were so ambitious and so driven, and the ideas about what they wanted for themselves were so grand. But this was a country without much agricultural land, with no industrial potential. It lived off tourists. It lived off Saudis and Kuwaitis and Iraqis who had oil but needed a place to play. They needed nightclubs, and Beirut provided the nightclubs. They needed a place where they could publish books, and Beirut provided this. It was a very small country with a very fragile economy of services and tourism. And all this, of course, now is in the past. I mean, the place has been ruined because there's no economic base to speak of.
You were talking before about how there was at least the image when you were growing up in Beirut of the different Muslim groups and the different Christian groups all communicating with each other on,
yes.
on some level.
Yes.
Now, whether that was just image or whether there really was that level of communication,
right.
it's all fallen apart.
Yes,
I mean,
communication
no longer exists. What are the origins of that breakdown, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it was what I call a necessary fiction, a necessary lie. We needed this. We needed to tell, the Lebanese needed to tell one another and to tell themselves that actually Muslim and Christian could exist. And there are really two ways of looking at the Lebanese dilemma and the death of Lebanon, the collapse of Lebanon, and the anarchy of Lebanon of the last 12 to 13 years. You could say, well, why did Lebanon collapse? And maybe there is another way of putting it, a prior way of putting it. How did Lebanon come together? You see, maybe the ingredients were never there. The ingredients were never there for one country. This Republic of Lebanon was put together, I mean, without getting too drawn into ancient history, but this republic was put together by the French in the aftermath of World War I. They added to Mount Lebanon, which had two communities, the Maronite and the Druze. They added to it the city of Beirut, which was essentially a Muslim Sunni city. And they added to it the Bekaa Valley, which they sliced off from Syria, which was predominantly Muslim Shia, and the southern part of the country. So it was always a hodgepodge. The country was drawn, you know, like many, many countries in Afro-Asia, the country was drawn by the colonial masters. It was drawn by the colonial masters. The dominant community in Lebanon, the Catholic Maronites, who were friends of the French, prevailed on the French in the aftermath of World War I, when the entire map of the Middle East was drawn and redrawn. They prevailed on the French to create this, what they call Le Grand Liban, the larger Lebanon, the bigger Lebanon, not just Mount Lebanon in the mountain, but the current borders of the Lebanese state. So from the very beginning, the country bore the seeds of its destruction. There was something there that was very fragile. The communities were of vastly different temperaments and different cultures, of various levels of development. The Christian communities in the mountain were much more developed than the Shia community in the hinterlands. The Muslims of take, for example, the coastal cities of Sidon in the south, Beirut in the middle of the in the heart of the coast, and Tripoli in the north. Take the city of Tripoli, some 50 miles north of Beirut. Now, this city of Tripoli was culturally far more connected to Damascus in Syria, mentally and economically and religiously, than it was to the city of Beirut. So when the map of the modern Arab world was drawn after World War I, this the entity of Lebanon, the modern entity of Lebanon, was from the very beginning a quilt, an impossible quilt of communities.
When you look at the fighting now between Muslims and Christians in Beirut,
yes,
what do you think of the fighting as really being about?
Well, you see, I think that's a wonderful question. I think the Lebanese may themselves not really remember what this is all about. But even take you know, we look at Beirut and we say that there is a war. There is a green line, ironically, a green line that divides Muslim West Beirut from Christian East Beirut. Now, traditionally, we used to think, and for a while, the war was across that green line. The Christians are on one side, the Muslims are on another side. But what's interesting about the place has been further dividing and subdividing. Now, you don't really have war across the green line. You don't have just Muslim killing Christian. Now, the most fierce fighting occurs within these communities. For example, take the Shia, the Muslim Shia, the stepchildren of Islam, if you will, the poorer Lebanese, the Lebanese allies of the Iranian revolution. Now, most of the passionate Shia fighting and the vicious Shia fighting has taken place between Shia mainstream people, this Amal militia, the mainstream militia of the Shia in Lebanon, and the Party of God, which is sustained by the Iranians and paid by the Iranians. Take the refugee camps, the Palestinian refugee camps. The fighting is not between the Palestinians and the Christians, because the Palestinians really don't run into Christians. It's between proponents of Yasser Arafat, of the PLO, and opponents of Yasser Arafat, and so on. Go over to the eastern part of the city. You don't have now Maronite Christian Catholics fighting Muslims. You have intra-Maronite war. Maronite has been fighting Maronite. It's really a fight over turf. And men have gotten, war has become a way of life. A generation has come into being. Look, this war broke out in Lebanon in 1975. It's now more than 13 years old. Now, if you were 5 or 6 years old when the war broke out, you have only known war as a way of life. Lebanon has redefined the normal. Normal is war. And I think it's a fight. Fighting becomes a way of life. The feud becomes the precious possession. A while ago, there was a vicious war broke out between the Shia underclass in West Beirut and the Palestinian refugee camp dwellers. And they were fighting over shells of gutted buildings. And these shells of gutted buildings were called strategic. There was nothing strategic about them. Men know only war, and they are now, that's the way of life that's open to them.
When you go back to Beirut to visit friends or family, what's the experience like for you, since the city has changed so much from the city that you grew up in?
Well, you know, there came a time when, in a way, the Beirut I knew was gone. For example, the part of Beirut that the precious part of Beirut that I was used to myself, this Armenian Shia slum in northeastern part of the city, that now fell behind Christian lines, and the Muslims were expelled from it. And so that part of the city is not even open. My own family, my mother, and parts of, you know, because some of them have left and some are still in Beirut, are in what, you know, what has been euphemistically called Little Tehran, the southern slums of Greater Beirut. And that's a completely different world. So of all the things that existed of that world, the old city that one knew, that's completely in the past.
We have very little time left, but I'm wondering, if the truce between Iran and Iraq holds, what effect do you think that's going to have on Lebanon?
I think it's a good question, and I think there may be even some implications here for the Western hostages, both the American hostages and other hostages who are being held in Beirut. There has been a parody in Lebanon of the Iranian Revolution. Little Tehran, if you will, is there. And in part, some of the passions of Lebanon have been fueled by the Iranians. The Iranians have needed a place where they could hold up to the rest of the Muslim world as an example of an Islamic revolution. It's conceivable, just conceivable, that if the Iranian revolution now admits its defeat, admits its inability to change the politics of the Muslim world, and turns its attention inward, realizes that the last decade was a lost decade, and that the attempt to change the politics of the Muslim world have failed, that they would channel less of their money and less of their fervor to Beirut, and it's conceivable that Beirut to the extent that you could single out the Iranian part of the agitation, that Iranian influence would be weakened, and that the Lebanese who answer to Iran will discover that they are on their own.
You know, earlier you used the expression that whether you think that the death of Beirut is from homicide or suicide.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you think. Do you think of the demise of the city as being homicide or suicide?
I think a bit of both. You see, I think it was always an unfair city, an unjust city. When the Lebanese, some Lebanese, yearn and grieve for the city, I've always felt that, of course, we're really talking about the pampered classes grieving for a city that the poorer classes don't really remember and never knew. And so whenever you meet people of any, you know, the so-called ancien regime anywhere, people who grieve for an old world, they grieve for something that they themselves knew and treasured and enjoyed. I think it was an unjust city. I think it was an unfair city. I think that there were people who were left out of the country. There were communities that were left out of the power and the resources of the country. And there are people who have no sorrow. There are Lebanese and residents of Beirut who really have no sorrow for the old Beirut. They don't want it back. Maybe they don't want what exists now, the ruin that exists now. But when you tell them of the city, you know, the graceful city by the Mediterranean, the city of nightclubs and the city of culture and so on, they don't remember it. They never knew it. It was not theirs. And there is an irony now that the poor have inherited the ruins of a city. And John Milton once said, you know, there's something very relevant to Beirut, that maybe it's better sometimes to be a master in hell than a servant in paradise, a servant in paradise. And for many of these young Party of God believers, these young militiamen, life is not perfect, but they don't want to go back to the past, for it was not a world that was fair and that was kind to them.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts.
Thank you for giving me a chance.
My guest has been Fuad Ajami, and he's the director of Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He grew up in Beirut. He's the author of the new book, Beirut, City of Regrets. It's published by Norton. Ajami wrote the text, and there are also photographs by Eli Reed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.